Sonia Morton Firth, and you're tuned in to the Sonia Morton Firth Show. Today, my guest is Helen Barnett. Helen was stabbed, shot, and blown up by the IRA, all in the line of duty. Helen served in the Met's infamous Armed Response Unit. One of the first women, she was awarded a Queen's Commendation for brave conduct. Watch this interview as we discuss being a woman in a man's world and how to keep on top of your mental health. Helen, thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on my show today. And, you know, you and I have tried to get this in the diary, I think, for close to a year now. And what with this lockdown, that lockdown, COVID restrictions, we haven't managed to pull off face to face. But, you know, I know your story, and I felt it was so important for me to get you on the show, even though it's on Zoom. I'm sure it'll still be very valuable, and one day we'll meet in person. So, Helen, welcome. Welcome to my show.
Oh, thanks so much. It's lovely to finally meet up, even if it's on at the end of our phones. It genuinely is, and it's, yeah, really privileged. Thank you for having me on your show.
Helen, listen, I've been researching into your background, and it's quite difficult to sort of know where to start. And I think really the best place to start in this case is, I guess, from the beginning, in terms of, you know, you were in the police force and you had these three incidences, and I'm going to let you talk about them more. But first of all, what is it that made you want to join the police in the first place?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good question. I grew up in a little village in the Cotswolds, and, you know, the older I get, the more I appreciate how lucky I was. And a lot of people don't have the kind of upbringing that I had. It was very simple and outdoors, and I was very sporty. So, yeah, I was a bit lazy at school academically, but excelled at sports. And so I guess it was sort of either a PE teacher, and I hadn't worked hard enough to do very well in my A levels, or sort of something else. Sort of help. I genuinely sort of had this, you know, feeling that I wanted to help people. Chose the police as that kind of route to do it, really.
That is a little bit controversial, isn't it? Depending on what era you're from, I guess, and your views on law enforcement, etc.
Absolutely, possibly slightly naively, you know, having grown up in a little Cotswold village. That was the image that I had. So yeah, I mean, that was genuinely my motivation. And it kind of landed me on this crazy path, and here we are now talking. So I guess if I hadn't have made that decision, I wouldn't be here talking to you, would I, Sonia?
Well, no, and your life wouldn't have, I'm sure, taken the turns that it did. And really, it has been sort of remarkable. But let's go back then to that first incident. So you joined the police, and you were in the Met Police.
Yeah, so I left home when I was 18, and I joined the Met Cadets, which was a year of just probably the best year of my life, actually. It was adventure training and sport and community service, you know, help volunteering in different sort of settings. I had a setting in like and helping mental health patients. It was all, you know, really absolutely sort of amazing foundation for a young person. Yeah, really brilliant. And I look back really fondly on that time. Yeah, and then I went to Hendon and did the normal sort of training that you do to be a constable. And much to my surprise, passed that as top student, you know, because I'd always thought I wasn't all that clever, you know, but I just sort of worked really hard. And and then was posted to a busy North London station just at the beginning of 86. So it was just after, going back quite a long time now, after the Broadwater Farm riots in Tottenham, where PC Keith Blakelock had been hacked to death. So I was working with people who had been with him, you know, and in hindsight, you look back all these years and think, gosh, you know, I definitely hit the ground running. And you know, so it was, it, that was sort of kind of the environment that I sort of went into as a young 19-year-old, very, very young and naive, and just learnt very, very quickly, to be honest.
And a hard environment. I mean, the police weren't best liked back in the day, especially in areas. And, you know, as a young police officer, I'm sure it must have been, you know, particularly difficult. I mean, how did you, if you can remember those times, how did you feel about the situation? Did you ever feel afraid going out on the streets?
I don't think I did, because I was probably, as we all are, a bit young and naive and sort of felt invincible, really. And I worked with a lot of really good people. It was an amazing time, to be honest, as a woman, because things were really changing. We were, you know, I look back and we were quite sort of groundbreaking, really, the roles that we were doing as women. You know, we were still issued with like half-sized truncheons and handbags, and actually but so the equipment hadn't caught up with the role that we were doing. So
what
were
you meant to do with that?
Exactly. I just left mine in my locker because it was just useless. So, and we were just literally allowed to wear trousers. So that's kind of what the era. There was no body armor, nothing like that. So that's the sort of era. So yeah, but I felt, you know, there was a real lot of opportunity for us as women, to be honest. Yeah. So yeah, that was setting the scene, really. So and just learnt, was getting on quite nicely, and I suppose it just leads me on. I got married quite young, had a young son, Ben, in 1990. So just was working, you know, no part-time working, no sort of anything like that to take into account that you'd got children. So, you know, that was the era that it was, really, and it was just, that was just normal.
You just sort of got on with it. It was, yeah, they didn't even take into account. It was almost like you had to step up, or, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of people just left, you know, if they had children. So it was quite unusual. So, yeah, juggling quite a lot of balls in the air, as we all do, you know, with family life. But, I suppose it leads me on, really, sort of, I was working on just shift work response, responding to calls, doing shift work. And leads me on to the sort of the first incident, if you wanted me to sort of talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think that's where it all began, I guess. I think that picture, that would be great, Helen.
Yeah, so takes me on to sort of September the 2nd, it was, remember it well, 1991. So yeah, Ben was 10 months old, and I'd gone on to a late turn shift, which was 2 in the afternoon till 10 in the evening, and I'd been posted driving the van and with a guy called John Davison, who was a sergeant and a friend of mine, and fortunately we were both this will make sense later, but we were both sort of very physically fit and into our weightlifting and strong sort of and we'd been chatting away, and it was just a very unusually quiet afternoon, and then a call came out, which was very, very, you know, usual call, nothing, no alarm bells ringing or anything, to just somebody, a guy in the Wood Green shopping area, the main shopping area, just causing a bit of a nuisance, really, outside a shop. So really nothing much more than that came over the radio. So we accepted the call, and because it was quite another panda car with two female police officers accepted it as well, which was quite unusual for a call like that, but I think it was just, you know, it was so quiet. So I pulled up outside the shop, parked the van at the side of the road, and John jumped out of his side and went into the shop that had called us, just to sort of find out from them really what had been going on a bit more, which was just normal, what you do. And I'd sort of noticed that the guy we'd been called to, he was very, very distinctive, a huge, huge guy. And his description of his clothes had crossed the road. So I jumped out of the van door and nipped through the traffic over to the path where he was stood. And he'd got his back to me.
And at no point in that, sorry to interrupt, Helen, getting out, seeing the guy, clearly a big guy. And I'm probably asking this as a woman, maybe you haven't been asked this guy, I don't know. But I think if you saw this big guy, and no one knows how they think, your reaction is to actually run towards him. Was there any moment you feared your own life, or you feared what could happen? Was your instinct just to go, which was part of your job?
Yeah, not at all. I mean, you know, I was 5'10". I was really fit and strong and young and just, you know, without blowing my treatment, you know, I felt I was a capable police officer, really, would get involved in anything. And there was nothing about it to indicate what he was about to do next. So, and I always really, I think it was just my upbringing, always just tried to speak to everybody really nicely and generally, you could diffuse people by just treating them like another human being, you know, and that was my, how I genuinely tried to deal with everybody I came across. He got his back to me, and I think I said something along the lines of, hello, you know, what's been going on? You know, that would have been how I would have spoken to him.
But you weren't aware he was carrying anything at this
not moment. At all. So I couldn't see his hands. So he was armed with a Swiss Army knife, which isn't a particularly big knife, but he'd got it sort of, if I show you, he got it like this. So he was holding the knife like that. I couldn't see the knife, and literally what I'm about to say sort of evolved in seconds. He swung round and he stabbed me in the stomach with all his might, you know, this mighty punch that's sent me flying back, hard to judge, but probably about 12 foot, and I was on the pavement. And just instinctively, I got up and I was just really angry. I remember sort of scrabbling up off the floor and thinking, God, that really hurt, thinking he punched me. This is just literally like faster than I can speak, Sonia. And so got up, was trying to sort of call on my radio, could see that my friend was being stabbed. She approached him, she was being stabbed. So I was like, just lunge forward just instinctively to stop him and try and arrest him, you know. Again, reiterating, we were completely unarmed, no body armor, just, you know, our white shirt sleeves. And yeah, in the blink of an eye, he'd sent me flying backwards again onto the path, and I'd been stabbed twice more. Just the speed of it, I really can't sort of reiterate how fast this all happened. And I was on the floor. He was stabbing Jenny, my other friend, Zara, across the road. She was just delayed set by seconds by a car. So in that time, we'd been stabbed 8 times.
Oh, wow. And was there any passers-by? Was there any people that were trying to help or do anything at this point? I'm sort of trying to visualise the scene in my head.
It was a busy shopping, very good question, actually, a really busy shopping centre. We were to be helped sort of later on, but at that point I don't know, and I don't think so, because he was just in this frenzy, absolute, you know. He was a schizophrenic, we found out, and he'd had a history of attacking police officers, and sort of the care in the community had broken down, so he's having this manic episode, and you know, he was just fueled by this. And Zara crossed the road, and she got stabbed. And all this time I was on the floor, and I remember just my white shirt literally turning red. And it was just that, I think that's the first time in my life that I'd felt fear like it, and sort of this feeling just confused and panic stricken, you know, what was going, I couldn't understand why there was blood, you know, why did he punch me that hard that I was bleeding? It was just, yeah, so, yeah, it was just, I think I must have closed down because my memory of it is quite limited of what was going on around me. I know Zara had been stabbed at this point. She was calling for help over the radio. And John, who'd gone into the shop, he'd obviously heard what was going on over the radio, and he came over. He got stabbed in the stomach, but he got helped by an off-duty PC and his wife, who helped him take the knife off the guy, Rupert West, his name was. He was, I think, from what I've been told since, that he was kind of calming down at this point. And yeah, so John managed to disarm him. So yeah, within about 90 seconds, we'd been stabbed 10 times between the four of us.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, what goes through your mind at that point? You didn't actually realise, you still at this point thought you'd been punched. You didn't realise, I guess.
Yeah, so it was, yeah, it was. I was lying on the floor, and one of those, the lady who'd been shopping actually was giving me first aid and some other people. And she, I remember hearing her say, oh, and she's been stabbed in the stomach as well. And somebody was really bearing down on my stomach. And I think that was the first realization that, you know, I'd been stabbed. Yeah, so I just was literally lying there thinking, stay awake, don't die. I was thinking of Ben, you know, all these things sort of going through my mind. And then I remember this feeling of sheer relief when started arriving.
Oh, Helen.
Yeah, incredibly reassuring.
Sorry, you just broke up. Could you repeat that? What did you say? I just heard you say you
felt
relief.
Yeah, relief when police officers started arriving and friendly faces. I knew that sense that, you know, no disrespect to anybody who was helping me because they were amazing, but, you know, just seeing familiar faces sort of looking down at me, you know. I remember the horror on their faces as well was just like clear to see. But and that was it. You know, we were given first aid, all of us, and taken off to various hospitals nearby.
And what were the injuries? I mean, how long did it take you to recover sort of physically from those injuries?
Yeah, I think my physical fitness, especially with the one in my stomach, was key. You know, I had a real strong core, and I think my injuries would have been more sort of internal than they actually were. So there was a deep puncture wound to my stomach, but, you know, I was very sort of fit and strong, and I'm convinced that really probably saved my life, to be honest.
Yeah.
And two very deep wounds, one right down to the bone. I've got a big scar sort of about that long on my shoulder and on my forearm here. But there's a bit of problem with sort of them healing, but yeah, very lucky, very 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 lucky. Yeah, you know, physically could have been a lot worse than it actually was, really.
And were you given did you have a lot of time off between when you returned, or and did you at any point think, do I want to return after this?
Yeah, so I think, I forget how long I actually had off, but it was a fair few months sort of physically healing. And yeah, it was difficult. I remember putting on my uniform again was difficult. And obviously I'd been at home with Ben, and yeah, it was, but there was no understanding around mental health then.
I was about to say, was there anyone on hand to sort of say, well, you know, how are you coping with this sort of mentally? Has it affected you?
Yeah, so then, you know, there really was no concept, you know, around mental health, mental well-being, really. You know, it just wasn't. We've come such a long way since, thankfully. And, you know, so it just wasn't really on the radar. You know, I trained a lot. So, you know, that was without me sort of realising, was probably, you know, a good coping mechanism. But yeah, obviously, clearly would have been very traumatised. But having said that, my character was, if somebody had probably said to me, you're mentally affected at that point, I'd have said, well, you know, no I'm not, you know, I'm a tough character, I'm resilient, you know, all those things you need to be. And so I probably wouldn't have been open to it at that point anyway, if that makes sense.
Really, you are resilient, that's for certain. And I guess at that time, you wouldn't have known either that you were affected mentally by the situation. It probably wouldn't have hit you at that point.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was just a matter of recovering physically and getting back to work. You know, and once I'd got over that hurdle of being frightened of, you know, putting my uniform on and that, and I just get back into it. And I don't think it affected me too much, you know, in the way I worked and everything. But it's hard, isn't it, to judge, you know.
But what I was so surprised when I listened to your story, it didn't just end there. I mean, that's already horrific. You've been stabbed 3 times. Take us to incident 2, and how long ago was incident 2 after this had happened?
Yeah, so first incident was 1991, and then 1993, Christmas 1993 was the second incident. So I'd been studying for my sergeant's exam, and I was just in an office with my radio on, and I could hear a call come over the radio that there was a recognised coded bomb threat by the IRA, again, to Wood Green shopping area, exactly the same place where I'd been stabbed, yeah.
Have you been back there since the start?
Oh yeah, lots. Yeah, I mean, that's where I was working. So yes, So all we knew was there was going to be some bombs going off in Wood Green shopping centre, which was, you know, vast, and it was Christmas time. Everybody was shopping. So we,
and I guess for a lot of people that may be watching this, I mean, I remember the IRA time. I think we're quite similar ages, Helen, but. There might be a lot of people that don't really remember. I mean, it was a genuine threat living in London in those days, and it was something. I mean, I remember I wasn't living in London, but I remember my father was, and I remember watching the news, being terrified that something might have happened to him when we heard about the IRA. It was a common occurrence, wasn't it, sort of thing, wasn't it, back then?
Yeah. Absolutely was at that point, wasn't it? Yeah, it was a campaign, wasn't it, that was that was real, and you know, a lot of people's lives were affected, weren't they? And I mean, you genuinely knew something was going to happen, but where, we, you know, just didn't know. So yeah, all we could do really was go down there and try and get people to come out of the shops, you know, doing their Christmas shopping. So just really without any, because we couldn't really plan anything, it was just thinking, you know, on our feet, just to get everybody out. And that's what I was doing, along with loads of colleagues of mine. We were just literally running from shop to shop, telling people there was going to be a bomb, to get out, doing that as quick as we could. And so I was in the process of doing that, and one of them went off, sort of hard to know how far away, but it was planted in a, weren't massive, but enough to do smash the shop windows, you know, that kind of damage. Some people were hit by flying glass. I was blown off my feet, and just remember getting up off the floor, sort of thinking, God, am I all right? What the hell's gone on? Feeling terrified again, that same feeling at the stabbing, really, and not knowing where the next bomb was going to be. It was just this feeling of panic, but you've got a job to do. So I joined up with a friend of mine who was on the path, and we just looked at each other, and I think we exchanged a few expletives, like, you know, it was just crazy. There was smoke and alarms going off and people running and screaming, and we just tried to carry on, you know, getting people out of the shops. And we moved away from another bin. We'd literally moved away a few feet and it went off again. So that was the second device that gone off behind us, which was truly terrifying. Again, we were lucky, you know, it was relatively small, but I lost track of time. We just carried on doing what we could, but, you know, it was pretty pretty terrifying, really. Nobody was killed. A few people were hit by flying glass. You know, I was uninjured, but it was just frightening. And then I was doing this, and then I suddenly had had this thought in my head, Ben, he's being brought by the childminder to a Christmas party at Wood Green. And I just, it was before mobile phones or anything. And I just thought, so I'm doing this job and now I'm having this thought about, I've got to stop them coming here. So I remember running into this paper shop. I said, please, can I use your phone? This makes me laugh now. It's so funny, you know. I rang home and said, you know, just Michelle, just don't bring him to Wood Green, just stay at home. I'll explain later. So it was just like,
wow.
Yeah, this going on in my head.
And then maternal instinct, because that's your first instinct to protect your son, your baby. Yeah.
Yeah. So and then some time later, I lost track of time. We were taken back to Wood Green, and we all got together in an office and just had a sort of a bit of a quick meeting just to check everybody was, you know, what they'd done, what part they'd taken, how they felt. And yeah, we just went home and life carried on, and I carried on studying my sergeant's exam, sort of threw myself into that, and it was just, you know, just another one of those things that had happened, you know.
So at no point, and this was, because this involved a few members of the police force, presumably, at no point did you get any sort of counselling or somebody chatting about what had happened, or...
Yeah, it was genuinely nobody's fault. It was just the times, you know. It was that was it. There just wasn't that sort of understanding of how the mind is affected by these awful things, really.
And again, just to ask you that, the same question I asked you before, did this not put you off going back?
No, it didn't. You know, I was studying, but you know, it definitely was starting. It's these layers, isn't it? Which we all have, these layers of life's traumas and things, nasty things that happen. We've all got them. They just build up, don't they? If we don't deal with them, they just build layer on layer. And I think that's what was happening. I trained to extreme, really, without sort of realizing that was a coping mechanism.
Were you seeing any other signs or anything at all that were coming through in other parts?
I mean, my marriage just went down the pan. So I'd got that to deal with. I was bulimic at one point. I look back and kind of probably that was a sort of form of control, wasn't it, over, you know.
Was that after your marriage breakup or the same?
Sort of at the same point. So, you know, it was just going pear-shaped, for want of a better phrase, you know, at home.
Do you think, because look, I mean, you know, we're talking, there's one thing we're talking about physical incidents as part of your job, and then you've got a marriage breakdown, which is hugely traumatic in terms of a sort of a relationship and an emotional part of you. If you look back now, do you think, which was, it's probably a difficult thing to answer, which felt worse, the physical side or the mental, I guess, anguish of going through a relationship breakup?
Yeah, I think really at that period of time, and for much of my life, really, I've just kind of just stuffed it all down. You know, it was clearly all very difficult, but just... just somehow just kind of tried to detach myself from it, which isn't a good thing, but I think that's how I coped with it, you know, and this busyness of training, you know, that was
I think going back each time back to the force where you'd had all these things happen to you, but actually it was still getting you away, I guess, from what was whatever was going on in your home life.
Yeah, and I joined, you know, to sort of have a 30-year career, and it, you know, it was that was it. So I just literally sort of knuckled down and carried on, and I suppose that kind of takes us on to the third sort of significant sort of you know, incident. So the following year, I decided to join the the armed response vehicles, so the firearms department, which was really, really unusual. They'd only just opened it up to women. So there'd been two women had joined shortly before me. So it was a real male environment.
How did that feel? How did it feel personally to get that job to be able to do that?
How
were you treated as a woman, as one of the only women?
Yeah, pretty well, really, because things were changing, and I think I said to you earlier, I look back and as women we were quite groundbreaking, changing things, really, things that had traditionally just been done by men. We didn't realize that at the time, and just sort of most people were of the same generation of me were joining, if that makes sense. So they were, although I was the only woman on my team, they were sort of they were changing things as well, if that makes sense, as men. There was the odd dinosaur that clearly didn't like change, but generally treated really well, really well. But it was a very difficult, stressful job, and I think being clearly so different by being a woman, you kind of had to, I was very aware that I didn't want to show any sort of signs of weakness or anything like that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. You're proving it. You're not just, you're trying to prove yourself to everybody else, and proving yourself as a woman. I mean, it's not similar, but I worked in the finance industry, which is very much a man's world, and you almost have to shut down the female parts of you and just take on a different persona going to work.
You get it, Sonia. That's it. Exactly. That's really what good way of putting it. So I was juggling Ben at home with childcare. That was difficult on its own, and then I'd taken on this even more difficult role. And I laugh really at myself, sort of continually making sort of my life more difficult, really.
Oh my God! And tell me a little bit about this armed patrol. So this is what the main armed unit now in the country.
Yeah, so it was literally in its infancy. It had just been started, and back then we wore exactly the same uniform. It was just white shirts and the black trousers. It's come such a long way. I look at how
protective padding in case you got shot at.
So we had body armor that was kept in the car.
Wow.
So it's changed beyond belief what they look like now. And yeah. So we were, it was a time of change. Yeah.
You go back and you think, well, why did you have to fit? I guess, was it so you didn't scare the general public, or was it you found out by the criminals that were going to do something?
No, I think it was more the thinking was, because I think there was an argument that actually we should have some kind of different uniform. I think the thinking was back then that they didn't want us to look any different. They didn't want us to stand out, that we were any different, probably for the reasons that you say that didn't want the general public to think, oh gosh, those officers are armed. But I mean, we've come such a long way now, haven't we, since then.
I live in London, you're used to it, I guess.
Yeah,
not much in the US, but yeah.
Yeah, so that was the thinking back then. So yeah, that's 1994, and Boxing Day 1994. We got a call just as we were going off duty, actually, and we'd gone back to the base to clock off and go home. And this call came out to help the local office, unarmed officers in North London again at Enfield. So. We made our way, and I was more than ready to go home. I was tired. I think we all were tired. Just that was our sort of mindset. So we made our way up to Enfield to support the local police, who'd had a call to a sort of domestic incident where this guy, who was eventually to shoot me, had abducted his baby toddler daughter in a pushchair from his estranged partner's And she called the police, and he was armed with a handgun. So basically, we'd been called. We'd formed up in a side road, and myself and a colleague, we borrowed some jackets to go over our uniforms, and we went and had a look at the flat where we knew he was holed up. He barricaded himself in this flat nearby. So Nick and I went and had a look at the flat, the door, the layout of the stairwell. So we made a few little sketch plans, and just so that, and he was more experienced than I. The plan was that we'd go around there and hopefully manage to sort the situation out. So we made our way back to the road, about just under a quarter of a mile away from the flat. And I remember being stood at the back of one of the firearms cars that we'd arrived in, and just thinking about, I'd rather be at home now. Sort of these thoughts were going through my mind, better get my body armor on, just sort of mundane sort of low key things. We were just sort of getting ready to go round to the flat where we knew he was. And then again, this all happened in the flash, blink of an eye, faster than I can sort of explain to you. I heard one of my colleagues say that it's him. And I looked up, and everybody just started reacting, and it just this chaos. And he'd followed us, and he was in the entrance to the roadway where our cars were parked up. So he'd appeared in the roadway with his toddler in the pushchair. So hadn't got my body armor on, and we just literally instinctively reacted. And I remember seeing a gun, running towards him. We were all kind of reacting, feeling this surge of terror again, thinking, I just want to just run in the opposite direction. That's sort of your human reaction, but you don't, of course. Filled with terror and adrenaline. And and the gun came out of his coat, it put it into his mouth. And again, this is just so quick that I can't explain, you just literally don't have time to think, you just react. And I was going for my sidearm, my Glock in my holster, and my handy, I hadn't even touched it. And as I was running forward, there was this, he outstretched his arm. So it went from his mouth to outstretched, and he shot me.
Oh my God.
And it was just surreal, really. It was just, everything stopped. And I remember sort of hearing a bang and a puff of smoke, and sort of everything closed down. And but I knew I'd been shot. There was no pain, but it was just like being hit by sort of a truck, really. A huge impact, and I fell onto the road. And my memory is a bit sketchy, because I think, again, you just must go into shock, mustn't you, and just like close down. But he was shot, I think, about 8 times, and my colleagues all returned fire. So it's all going on around me. I've only recently been told I was dragged behind one of the police cars, but I have no memory of that. But I've just literally within the last couple of weeks told that somebody pulled me to safety round behind one of the cars, but I actually can't remember that. I just remember finding myself behind one of the cars. The bullet had gone through the front of my knee, round the side, and come out the back.
I mean, you said just before that you didn't you realised you'd been shot, but it didn't hurt, or you weren't in pain. I think you said you weren't in pain. I've never been shot, touch wood, quickly. But I can imagine, and I've spoken and interviewed a lot of veterans that are in the military, and I guess it's that the adrenaline is it that stops that pain, because your body's in fight mode rather than flight mode, so it's all geared up. At what point did you feel the pain? Because I guess there must be a point where you're then, that the danger situation is sort of the immediate is gone, and then the pain is in at some point.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Sonia. That's exactly what must have been going on, wasn't it? Yeah, and it kicked in really quickly once I was on the floor, and because we'd gone with an ambulance, that they'd come with us, and so they started tending to me on the floor, and my colleagues came over, and I think my friend Richard, who I'd worked with years ago, he was there and he looked down at me and said, "Oh God, not you again." We had like this this sort of dark humor, you know. And then the pain, it was like just excruciating, nothing like, you know, it. So I guess once I felt safe, the pain kicked in.
I mean, that point of humor, it's interesting, not you again. I mean, what was the mindset that kept you going? Because I mean, it's like the Rocky movie, isn't it? You kept on getting hit, but you kept getting back up, you know, not physically at that time, but you kept going back and doing your job and protecting our people. What's the mindset behind that? I mean, is there anything you can describe that kept you going?
I don't know. I think possibly it came from, you know, the childhood that I spoke about earlier. You know, we were sort of outdoorsy type people. You know, if we fell out of a tree or whatever it was, you know, you hurt yourself, your mum took you off to A&E, and that just kind of resilience that was sort of somewhere inside me. I don't really know. Mum and dad were just really hardworking people, so I got this ethos that you worked hard. So, you know, it was my job. You know, financially, you know, it was an income as well. So a lot of things. I just got that sort of stubborn mindset, and I think an ability to kind of, I did it with my training. You probably know a bit, you know, about this, Sonia. You can push yourself beyond that sort of pain barrier. So I kind of got that sort of mindset, I think. That's the only way I can describe it, really. But I mean, I didn't return to work after the shooting. You know, that was literally, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back.
I'm not surprised. How did you recover from that? Both, I guess, physically and mentally. I mean, you said the bullet, just to talk on the physical aspect, you said the bullet went round your knee, and I know you've gone on and done other challenges since, which we'll get on to, but physically, did it take you a long time to sort of recover?
Yeah, so again, physically, I was so lucky. I mean, I was told by a specialist, it was like millimeters away from would have shattered my knee, so I'm eternally thankful, really am. It got a bit infected because it got at the local hospital, they stitched it up, both the exit and entry was stitched up, so it was a bit of a mistake, so it got all infected and I had to have it treated at the Woolwich Military Hospital at the time, that went and had treatment there. And but once that was sorted out, it grumbles a bit, but nothing that's ever stopped me. I am genuinely so thankful that, my life could have been very different physically, couldn't it? So,
do you ever look back and think, three times, is there a reason why I'm still here? Do you ever sort of think, I mean, you could have gone on any of those occasions. I mean, not many people have been shot, stabbed and blown up and are still here.
Yeah, and I think that has been my mindset. I mean, obviously, you know, we all have really dark, low times, don't we? But I think I just generally felt lucky and fortunate, and I think, that mindset has really helped me. Sometimes, this will sound really bizarre, in the early days, I wished I'd been, and I really don't wish this now, but in the early days, I wish there was something more to show physically. Does that make sense? Because obviously then I was really traumatized by this third major event. And that was quite hard for me, you know, this resilient character. And sometimes I wish there'd been more to show that why I was, you know, obviously mentally injured, but physically, you know, this big, tough, muscly, strong woman, you know, that does that make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, it completely makes sense, but you've been through so much and okay, you've still got your limbs and you're, you know, able to walk, etc. but you'd still taken a hell of a beating, and not many people would keep getting back up. And sometimes it's, I don't know, and I can't imagine this, but it's sometimes it's not always the physical side, it's what it's doing to us mentally each time. Now more than ever, you know, and I don't think we're seeing the full effects of what's going on now with lockdown number three. And I do think it will affect a lot of people's mental health, being sort of stuck at home and not being able to get out, and all the other horrible implications that this pandemic is having on us. But I think the mental scars, I think, far outweigh the physical scars in a lot of ways.
And, you know, I was very lucky in a way. I've got some amazing, my federation rep, Colin, he's now, one of my best friends, was just magnificent. And his understanding of mental health and wellbeing was way beyond the time. And he was like really my voice and fought my corner. And I'm forever thankful for him. And I did get eventually got funding and got some amazing treatment, and got diagnosed in 95 with post-traumatic stress disorder, which was really quite unusual then. And it was a kind of double-edged sword. It was good that I realised I wasn't actually going mad, but it was a diagnosis that kind of, you stuck with this disorder. That was kind of the thinking of it back then.
And I guess, I don't like that, even the word disorder, post-traumatic. I mean, it's trauma, isn't it, that you suffered? I mean, I don't really see how it's a disorder at all. That word itself isn't the greatest word to use. And how did you get help for your recovery, or not? In terms of on the mental side of things, on helping you with that side.
Yeah, so I was very fortunate, got this funding from the Met. After that was quite difficult, because after you feel like you've given your all to this job that you kind of love, and then your realization that it doesn't love you back was quite a hard thing to deal with. But I got really good funding eventually, thanks to some good friends and Colin, and to see Professor Gordon Turnbull, who was like, he still is, really top of his tree with trauma. And so got some really good help. And that kind of went over a year, this sort of help from their program that they ran, which was really great. But then ultimately I was, faced with being medically discharged in 96 with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Just taking you back, I just want to pick up on something you said, the realization that this job that you'd given everything for, and not just everything, you'd given your life for pretty much, and realizing they don't love you back. I mean, I I've had a similar experience, not to that extent, because my life was never on the line. But I did give I gave every hour, certainly in my early career, to corporate life, and slept with a BlackBerry by my bed, working till 2 a.m, traveling every God knows, and not having any sort of life outside work. And then the final realization for me when I came out of corporate life was they just didn't care. They just don't care. I think that was the biggest flop in the ocean.
Similar experiences to me, Sonia, isn't it? You get it. You sacrifice in whatever way it is,
I mean, it wasn't my life. You just have the much more extreme sort of version. So, I mean, I can imagine that must have felt awful. Because when I had that realization, I was angry, actually. I was quite angry with, why have I spent so long of my life giving everything, and actually you don't give a shit, quite frankly.
Yeah, there were individuals, don't get me wrong, there were some amazing individuals within it that really fought my corner, but the system, I'll call it the system, whatever you want to call it, didn't care. That was really tough and hard. And I handed in my warrant card. Felt I couldn't go on anymore, because there was Ben considering it. He was 4 by now. It was a hard decision to make, but I handed my warrant card in, and that was it. The door was shut. There was no social media back then, so sort of there were no support groups, there was, you know, a few very good friends, but that was it. You're just gone. And
I mean, how did you know, group? Because that had been your life up until that point. I mean, how did you feel? How did you, you must have felt a sort of sense of a loss of identity of who you were.
Yeah, complete loss of identity and purpose, and it's very difficult, even more so being a woman. I'd done this job that was quite unusual, you know, I'd gone into these male. Yeah, so I'd got all these amazing sort of life skills, these skills, you know, of being able to drive fast, the cars fast, I'd done my advanced drive, I could shoot people, and then there I was, I felt like an alien, literally, like a fish out of water, and it was difficult.
Did you have that many female friends at that time that weren't in the police?
No, I did get some, I mean, through the children, but there's always this layer of me that was disconnected, if that makes sense, Sonia, yeah. That I just buried and just didn't talk about. And so, you know, had the kids, did various different jobs, you know, and did some sort of sporting challenges. You know, I think I broke the British indoor rowing, you know, the Concept 2 rowing record for the mile for my age group. I got involved in these sort of things as I went along, and just never ever spoke about, you know, what happened to me. It was just you know, shut the lid on it, and that was it, really. You know, had another failed marriage, so I think it's come out in relationships, you know, and all the things that brings along, and you know, the heartache it causes the kids. So, you know, it impacts on your children as well, you know. And
don't you think the whole thing's linked? Yeah, I mean, obviously we're all connected, but there's links there, isn't there? I guess if one area of your life you're not feeling whole in yourself, and you don't feel that sense of purpose, identity, that's I guess going to spread into other areas of life, such as relationships.
Yeah, definitely. And a sense of, you know, your self-worth sort of goes that completely low, and probably much of the time nobody would have ever realized this, you know, on the outside, really. Yeah, and really that's how kind of my life sort of unfolded. And then we jump on to
say, where was the point where you sort of, if you did have sort of this realization that you had suffered and that you were going to try and change things, or you know, what was that moment, or what all those moments?
Well, it sort of came about really randomly, about just over 80, coming up for 2 years in May, this May, so it would be 2 years. And Ben, who I talk about, who's 30 now, phoned me up one evening and said, "Mum, I'm part of a charity event. So there's 12 of us going to break the 24-hour deadlifting world record for Rock to Recovery to raise money for the veterans. We need somebody else. Somebody's just dropped out." So there, I'm 53.
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. So this is like, wow. Okay. And that is, yeah. I know what deadlifting's like. I tend to do the Romanian deadlift, which is much more hamstringy, because I find the technique with deadlifting is so, it's a difficult technique to get. And had you deadlifted before?
Well, yeah, but I said yes. And then we finished a conversation and I thought, God, what have I let myself in for? What actually is I think I know what a deadlift is. So that was it. I knew I'd be way older than all these, you know, they were mainly military veterans. I was probably going to be probably nearly 20 years older than some of them.
Good for you. I'm just saying, good for you.
So I'd said yes. I was full of anxiety, trained as hard as I could, trained with Ben when I could, because, you know, but was so anxious.
Do you remember what weight you were lifting?
So we lifted 80 kilos for an hour and broke the hour record. So we did rotated, literally, the 12 of us. that was for an hour, and we broke the hour world record, and then we dropped it to 60 kilos for the 24 hours.
How many reps were you doing within your...
So you probably did about 10, and then the next person jumped on. You just kind of did it like that, and so that was, it was kind of a turning point. Did that, pushed myself beyond the darkest place ever, and I think, yeah, I was ill for about a week after, and you can imagine, Sonia.
Yeah.
But it was a real, Dan Elliott, who helps with Rock to Cover, they came down, and Jason Fox came down and supported us. And Dan Elliott, who does a lot of helping in the background, said he had a conversation with my boys, who were, you know, both there, and about me, and he said something like, if you ever need any help, it just, I can't even remember what he said, but he was really kind and touched something. And I thought, and it just resonated that actually, you know, I'm suffering badly with anxiety and stuff. Anyway, cut a long story short, because I could drive it on forever. And they ended up giving me a bit of help from Rock to Recovery with my anxiety, ironically. There's me trying to raise money for them. And
what sort of tips, can you give any tips or things that they helped you with? Or
just, just the realization, you know, that going through what, you know, what I'd gone through was normal, and the anxiety had sort of evolved over it's a quite a hard thing to explain, the techniques that they use, but it really sort of helped me, set me back on my path. I didn't need much help, it was kind of a self-realization, but it sort of led me on to finding Nick Goldsmith, who I know you've met and, yeah, and interviewed.
Yeah, I met Nick, I was going to say, about this time. It wasn't this time, it was the hottest day of the year last year. And we just got out of lockdown one. And myself and my cameraman, we drove down to see Nick, who's outside Bristol, and his amazing woodlands. And yeah, we did a great interview, and he showed me how to carve wood, and it was fantastic. And yes, he mentioned you then, but carry on. Sorry, Helen, I'll let you finish. But,
so, yeah. you know exactly what I'm talking about, the magic of him and the place and his wife, Louise. And so I started following them because they were linked in with Rock to Recovery and following on Instagram. And they were then advertised to the Wooden Warrior for veterans and emergency services people to go down there for a weekend. And I thought, oh, no, I can't, I'm not bad enough. You know, it's just too long ago. All these sort of, this chatter in my head.
Very humbling. Or is it to do with self-worth as well?
Self-worth as well. And also, I'd lived with it for so long, it kind of become just my normal kind of story.
Yeah,
all those things. Anyway, I did pluck up courage, emailed them, and to cut a long story short, went on their Woodland Warrior program with some injured veterans and did exactly what you say, Sonia. We wood carved, we made fire, we just all these simple things in nature. And the magic of the man. He just said, Helen, you've got a story that you need to tell. It's so current, you know, just these odd bits that he threw in there that, you know, we did some interviews and for BBC, and I remember thinking, God, I hope I can remember my story. I've never spoken about it. It was really odd, you know. It was just such a long time that I'd buried it, you know. To even think, can I remember my own story, was sent me, you know, full of anxiety.
Obviously, since then you've talked about it and in various different interviews and podcasts. How does it feel talking about it now?
Yeah, so that was thanks to Nick, and he put me in touch with different people, and you know, and it now I am fine, but I was very, very nervous in the beginning because, you know, just literally I hadn't spoken about it. And so it's been, I started doing public speaking, obviously that's dried up because of you know, the situation that we're in now. And and then this amazing other charity sort of spotted me through the interview that I'd done with Nick on the BBC, the Pilgrims Bandits charity, but the Curtis Palmer program, which is sort of extension of Pilgrims Bandits, and but it's for the emergency services, police. And they got in touch with me, And so I was going to Norway on an expedition with them last summer, but that got cancelled. But we ended up just fitting in an expedition to Snowdon in between sort of lockdowns. So we went to Wales and did mountain climbing and different things. And so I'm involved with, you know, helping them now, which is, right. You know, has also come from this, you know, the work that they're doing, and hopefully, you know, helping other people through sort of my experiences. And, you know, they're doing amazing work. I've also got into this sort of holotropic breath work with a guy called Sam Murray, who's a veteran, and Miranda Bailey. They've developed a technique of a version of like what Wim Hof has done. But they've adapted it because I found it very traumatic breathing like that. So they've adapted it working with sort of my experiences. They've adapted their techniques and been doing that in the cold water after. And it's just mind-blowingly incredible. I've been on a 10-day breathing program through the Curtis Palmer program with them, and it's been life-changing. But it's been quite a difficult thing for me to get it, you know. Initially it did make me quite anxious, but it's, you know, really shifting a lot of trauma, and it's just so powerful. It's amazing.
I might ask you for the links and we can put it in the show notes below.
Really passionate about getting it out there. I think if it can help me, who's been sort of, you know, this sort of trauma sort of almost stuck physically here for all that time. I really have had to work at it, you know, so it's not something that's instantly, but it's such an amazing tool that people could use in, you know, in their daily lives. Really, really passionate about what the work that they're doing. Really wanted to get it out there that, you know, how much it could help people. And I literally feel the layers, and we do a meditation after the breathing, and you just go to this place of peace that's just, and then you get in the cold water and the endorphins, serotonin, dopamine, all the things we get from that training, you know. You get from, you know, the breathing, cold water and the meditation. It's such a powerful thing. And really passionate that just want to help other people so that they don't suffer, really. And they can help themselves.
Amazing. Well, we'll definitely put those on the show notes. So what's next? Have you thought about what's next for you, or?
I obviously we're all in these strange times, aren't we? And we're doing what we can on Zoom and all the things that we can do. It's just really going back to why I joined the police, to help people. I just feel like if I can, you know, get what Nick's doing, the good work he's doing, carry on. I'm patron of Woodland Warrior program now, so if I can, by telling my story, my experiences, link in other people to be helped by him, and, you know, carry on working with Nick and Curtis Palmer program, the work that they're doing, you know, the power of the outdoors, nature, exercise, breathing, that your diet, you know, just I think that's my passion, really, just to carry on. Because when I went, literally there was nothing, and that sense of, you know, isolation was immense. You know, I didn't probably realize it at the time. So just connecting people to these amazing things that are out there that can genuinely help them. And if it can help me after 30 years of being sort of stuck in it, you know, with this trauma, it can help. I think it can help anybody, can't it, Sonia? It really can.
Absolutely. So I'm going to put, because, you know, my mission, obviously shining a light on your mission, and get that advice and that help out to other people. So I'll get the links after this, Helen, from you, and we'll put those in the show notes and we'll put that out as part of the interview. Because I think now more than ever, and it's really funny, because I'm looking out my window here. I've got an absolutely beautiful view of the outdoors, of the river. And I think that would be one thing I'd say, you know, everyone's stuck, isolated, and, you know, we're all going through our own mental suffering, either mental or physical suffering because of the situation we're in. But you just said, Helen, you know, getting out there, and you know, obviously we can't go to shops and restaurants and bars anymore, but we can still go outside and exercise and walk, and just being in nature and outside, I think, and you know, it's bloody cold out there at the moment, but you know, put your scarf on and do it, because there is nothing worse, I think, especially mentally, when you're not in the right place, just sit on your own at home, just go for a walk. I mean, I don't know what you feel, Helen, you mentioned.
Oh, so absolutely can't agree with you more. So passionate, you know, and obviously, you know, I touched on earlier, you know, we've got little Harry who's 8, and you know, I try, because one of the techniques, I'll go back a bit, Miranda Bailey, who works with Sam, she's a breath practitioner, she's amazing. She got me just nasal breathing. So all my life, you know, I've had this stuck anxiety, trauma, breathing, sort of from the top, she got me nasal breathing. So honestly, it's virtually eradicated my anxiety just by breathing through my nose.
And they say a lot of people breathe up here in their chest, and that's where all the you know, that's not the good place to breathe from.
Yeah,
shallow breathing, isn't it, that causes the anxiety.
Stuck in that fight or flight, really. Yeah. And it gets you into that rest and digest, the parasympathetic nervous system. So, you know, you think how many people now, you know, even like little Harry, the environment, you know, the schools are closed, the fear that's out there, and we're all frightened and anxious, aren't we? And it, you know, I'd explain to him at 8, you know, breathe through your nose and tell your friends, tell your teacher, you know. I know it sounds ridiculously simple, but honestly, Sonia, it's transformed how I feel, and it's enabled me to do this more holotropic, more, you know, deep breathing through that we do. But such a simple, powerful thing that people can do.
I really do think that that's one good thing that's come out of all this, because it's always good to look on the positive, is we've had to sort of slow down. Life's had to slow down. We've had to look at ways of, mindfulness, different ways of healing ourselves. And like you say, it's breathing techniques, meditation, just taking some time outdoors in nature. All of these things that don't involve money. They don't involve materialistic things. They don't involve rush, 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 or busy, busy, busy. But actually, it's just the simple things, I think, in life that can help us.
Totally. And you know, so many, you know, you've interviewed people, all these veterans, you know, I see it, you know, who self-medicate in whatever way, you know, or, you know, same in the police, you know, all these things that we turn to try and make ourselves feel better. But actually, you've got to stick with these things. They don't happen overnight, but so much we can do to help ourselves, you know, and just connecting with people that can maybe set us on this path and support us. But you know, so as you said, so much is actually quite simple, and if it can keep us away from, you know, all these toxic coping mechanisms, you know, I just passionately sort of want to share how I've been helped by just the mainly military veterans, really. It's amazing.
Definitely. Helen, look, I could talk to you all day.
Thank you. Sorry.
I have got my final question that I have to ask you. And that is, if you were to write a message in a bottle for future generations to find, what would that message be?
Sorry. This will sound really corny. It's just to be kind and share the love. And, you know, that has got to be the way forward. I know we've got these difficult jobs, you know, and things to do, but to share the love, you know, and just be kind to one another, and be kind to yourself, and just, you know, believe in yourself and love yourself, and shit, and then part that will pass on to the people that you interact with. And you know, it just and that never to give up hope, you know, however dark things get. Love never it. Give up.
Helen, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thanks, Sonia. I've loved it. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Remember, there's a new interview out every Monday, so hit subscribe and like, and you'll get it straight into your inbox.